Chapter 24. Present day. I remain calm and don't let any emotion show, which is easy since this is not the first time I've seen this video. Okay, this is it. Both of the detectives are looking at me expectantly. That's Luca Marino, I say after a few quiet seconds. The two detectives look at each other, then back to me. Detective Crofton asks,
Luca Marino?
Yes. The woman in that video is Luca Marino. I spent years and years protecting the identity of Luca Marino, making sure I could go back there and be that girl. I've already bought the land to build the dream house Mama and I planned. Already have the landscaping plans for the garden Mama would have loved. But when that name was threatened, I realized it was just that. A name. I spent years protecting the idea of Luca Marino, but I'm no longer that naive little girl. While it was hard to finally make the decision to let her go, the truth is she's been gone a long time. I don't need to be Luca Marino to keep the memory of Mama alive, or to do the things Mama would have wanted me to do. All eyes are on me, including Rachel.
Let me get this straight. You're saying that's not you,
Detective West says. My eyebrows raise and my mouth drops open, and then I tilt my head and give them a quizzical look. The woman in that hotel room is Luca Marino. I don't know how else I can say it. They could hook me up to a lie detector, and I'd pass with flying colors. Rachel breaks in.
My client is referring to a woman who recently spent time in Lake Forbing, Louisiana. She was in a car accident a week ago and did not survive.
I nod and add, Luca lived here when Amy died. She knew Amy.
Do you know her connection to Amy Holder?
Detective West asks. She has pulled out her laptop and is presumably doing a search on Luca Marino.
Again, Rachel says, we're not here to answer questions about Miss Holder's associates.
I hold a hand up and say, it's okay, Rachel. I can answer this. I've got to frame this just right. Amy was mixed up with some bad people. Luca was a part of that. That's all I can tell you.
Again, it's all in the tone.
They hand me a few more pictures, images I already knew they had, including the one of me dragging Amy from her car to her house. I look them over and shrug. The person in all these images is Luca Marino. Detective West is engrossed in the information she has pulled up on the screen. Detective Crofton leans in closer and mumbles,
the resemblance is striking.
Guessing they found her picture, I lean to the side and glance at her screen. Yep, it's the one from James's mother's Facebook post about that stupid soup. She's got her hair pulled back, no makeup, jeans, and a plain tee. We could be twins. Mr. Smith may be regretting finding such a perfect match. By now, Detective West should also be pulling up records that Devin created, which will show Luca Marino rented an apartment in downtown Atlanta in the timeframe around Amy's death. For good measure, there will also be a couple of parking tickets for a vehicle registered in that name down the street from where Amy lived, proving she had been in that area. When Devin and I parted ways in Nashville, I drove to North Carolina, but Devin went back to Louisiana. When these detectives call the Lake Forbing police and ask about Luca Marino and her time there, they will be told about the file folder full of pics and information on Amy Holder discovered in a forgotten bag in James's room, the bag Devin planted there. He also called the police as one of the helpful church volunteers, alerting them there was one more personal effect of Luca Marino to add to the others they'd collected to ensure they had it in their possession.
Why would Luca Marino follow you to Louisiana?
Detective West asks. I shrug. That's not something I can answer. I'm not here to solve their crime. I'm only here to ensure they look in the direction I want them to. My boss worked really hard to find someone who looked just like me so she could assume my identity and make it hers. He splashed her all over social media and made sure she was the talk of the town. He locked it up tight, covering all the bases, and then he killed her off. Killing her off also made it impossible for them to question her, so there's no one to go against what I'm saying to the detectives today. Mr. Smith thought he was just making it difficult for me to one day go back to my real identity, but yesterday I put the final nail in the coffin, so to speak. Thanks to the uniform from Goodwill and my last stop in Eden, the woman's dental records now match a set in a dentist's office in Eden, North Carolina,
under the name Luca Marino, making the idea of her body complete. If I'm losing Luca Marino forever, it's going to be worth it. The two detectives are lost to the computer screen while Rachel eyes me from across the table. I stare right back at her. Detectives, she finally says. We've come all this way, and yet there's absolutely nothing connecting my client to the death of Amy Holder. Now, unless there's something else, we will check into this new information. But to make sure we cover everything we need from you, can you tell us where you were the night of August 27th? They're not ready to pull the plug on this yet. I relax in my chair, calm, controlled. I look back at my calendar after I learned from the police in Lake Forbing there was a warrant out for me, so I could see where I was when Amy died. I went to a friend's house that night for dinner. He and his wife just had a baby, and they invited me over to see him. The only lie in my response was the date of the dinner. That dinner took place the week before. Detective West has her pen poised over her notebook. Can you give us the name and number of who you dined with that evening? Yes, of course. His name is Tyron Nichols. Detective Crofton's head pops up.
Tyron Nichols, who plays for the Falcons?
I smile. Yes, he's an old friend. Another truth. Holding up my phone, I say, I told him I had an appointment with you this morning. He said to call if you need to verify anything with him. Would you like me to get him on the line? I know he'd rather me not give out his private number if it can be helped. Detective Crofton jumps at the chance to talk to one of the best-known players on the Atlanta Falcons. I decide to FaceTime him because seeing is believing. Tyron appears on the screen. He's sitting in his chair in his home office. On the wall behind him are framed prints, articles, and jerseys depicting his time playing football in high school in Central Florida, then later at Ole Miss under Coach Mitch Cameron, and then his rise to the NFL. He's come a long way from that naive 18-year-old kid whose biggest dream was a full-ride scholarship to play college football in the hopes of one day being able to give his family a better life.
Hey, girl,
he says in his big, booming voice. Hey, Tyron. Do you have a sec to talk to these detectives? I roll my eyes for good measure.
Sure. Put them on.
I hand my phone to Detective Crofton, who looks absolutely giddy.
Yes, hello, Mr. Nichols. I'm Detective Crofton with the Atlanta PD. We need to verify Miss Porter's whereabouts on the night of August 27th. She says she was at your home that evening.
I sit back in my chair and find Rachel staring at me again. I give her a small smile.
Of course,
Tyron says.
She was here that night. It was the week of our home game against the Saints. During the season, Tuesday nights are the only nights I'm home for dinner, so that was the best time for her to come over and see our son.
Detective Crofton is satisfied, but Detective West is less starstruck and has another question. What time did Miss Porter arrive and depart from your home that night?
I picked her up after I left the practice facility, which would have been around 5. She stayed pretty late since we haven't seen each other in a while. Her and my wife got into a bottle of wine sometime around 9 or 10, I guess.
He lets out a loud laugh.
And then, of course, they had to break out the karaoke machine. Lord, those two think they can sing.
Locked up tight. Detective Crofton says,
Thank you. We've got everything we need. We appreciate your cooperation. Sure. Anytime,
Tyron says. Detective Crofton hands the phone back to me, and I look at Tyron on the screen. Thanks for clearing that up. He laughs.
No problem. You're coming by for dinner since you're in town, right? You won't believe how big Jaden has gotten.
Of course. I'll call you when I leave here and we'll make a plan. I end the call and turn my attention to the detectives. They are looking at me. Then they look at each other, sharing a silent communication. Detective West closes her notebook. I think that covers everything we have for today. If we have any further questions for Miss Porter, we'll be in touch. It only takes a few seconds for them to pack their belongings and leave the meeting room. Rachel and I are still sitting across from each other. You didn't know who Luca Marino was when she first showed up with James at the derby party, she says. I shake my head. If you remember correctly, I mentioned he showed up with a woman. I didn't comment on whether or not I knew her. This is why I tell the truth as often as I can. Rachel gets up from her chair and smooths down her skirt. Well, This seems like it's all wrapped up in a neat little bow. I shrug. I'm just relieved it's over. It's not over. Not for me. While I've dealt with one of the threats against me, it's the other one that poses the greatest danger. She grabs a briefcase and heads toward the door, but doesn't open it.
Yes, me too. I'd hate to think you had anything to do with that woman's death.
Looking right at her, I say, if there's one thing you can believe to be true, Luca Marino was the woman in the room with her that day. We watch each other for a few seconds. Then she slips out of the room without another word. While Rachel gets to walk away from here without a thought, I'm facing a different situation. My departure won't be as smooth as my arrival. I pull the new clean phone from my bag and call Devin once I'm out in the hall. I'm clear with the police, I say as soon as it connects.
Good, he says. Now let's handle the other problem.
Ryan was here when I arrived. I need him gone. Can you help with that? I can hear the familiar clicking sound that means he's hammering away on his keyboard.
What's he wearing today?
The image of him forms in my head. Jeans, blue Oxford button-down.
Okay. I'll call the hotel security and report him for suspicious behavior. It won't stick for long, but should probably give you enough time to get out of the building. Switch to the Bluetooth earpiece. I want to be on the line with you.
I dig the small, flesh-colored earbud that Devin designed out of my bag and sync it to the phone. I pull my hair out of the ponytail and slide the earpiece inside my right ear. It matches my skin tone, and having it hidden behind the curtain of my hair should make it hard to spot. I shove the phone in my back pocket and head out into the hall. The fact that Devin has insisted I keep this line open while I'm walking into the lion's den hits me hard. He's making himself vulnerable right now for me. In case I can't say it later, thank you for everything. Thank you for being my friend. He clears his throat.
We're not doing that shit right now. Head in the game. Just start walking if you need to. It's never too late to bail.
I push the metal bar at the end of the hall that leads to the stairwell. The concrete room is damp and dark, and my voice echoes off the walls. I'm headed down. When I get to the lobby level, I push open the door slowly and peek out just in time to see two uniformed hotel security guards approach Ryan. They move closer to him, saying words I can't hear while he glances around the big area. They motion to him to follow them, but he argues, still paying more attention to the elevators than the men in front of him. They grab him, one on each side, and he momentarily seems to put up a fight before relaxing in their hold. As they escort him away, he throws one last look behind him. As soon as he's gone, I slip out of the stairwell and whisper, moving to the exit.
I'm tapped into the street cams, so I'll see you as soon as you clear the doors.
The closest exit is a door that lets out on the side street. I'm steps away when I hear,
Hey, Luca.
I spin around and freeze when I see who it is. Fancy seeing you here, George.
Get him on the street,
Devin says in my ear.
I don't have eyes on you in there.
You shouldn't be surprised since you stood me up yesterday, he says.
I nod toward the door to let him know we're taking this outside. He nods back as if he's good with it.
Gotcha. Start walking north to the intersection,
Devin tells me. Even though I can't see the cameras, I feel some relief that someone else in the world is watching out for me, even if there isn't too much he can do for me right now.
You're plan B if the detectives strike out, right?
It takes everything in me to keep my voice strong and steady. George laughs.
I was supposed to be plan A. If you just gave him what he wanted, you wouldn't have had to bother with those cops.
I shrug and look at him as he walks beside me. Until next time I piss him off. He just pulled the card out again. I mean, there's no statute of limitations on murder.
Maybe you should have thought about that before you lit that match, he says quietly. Ryan has left the hotel.
Devin again. I take a deep breath and let it out slowly. Then one more. My regrets are long, and I'll have to live with the things I've done. And then I meet his gaze. You don't have to do this. We stop a few feet from the crosswalk and he stares at me, his eyes roaming my face.
I don't want to do this, but I have to get what's in that safe deposit box. We both know that's the only option right now. My hands are tied, Luca. You haven't left me any other choice.
And then what? I whisper. His hands go to his hips, and he steps away from me, his eyes sweeping the streets. He turns back to me.
Maybe I'll be distracted while I check what's in the box. Maybe I won't see that you disappeared.
He wants me to think he'll let me go. And he might right now, but it won't be long before I see him over my shoulder. The light flashes that we're cleared across the street, and we walk the next two blocks in silence until we're standing in front of the bank.
If you were gonna walk, now is the time,
Devin says in my ear.
Once you go inside, there's no turning back.
George starts up the steps to the entrance of the bank while I'm frozen.
You coming?
He asks. I shake it off and follow him instead. Walking away was never an option. Alias, Regina Hale. 6 months ago. The smell of sulfur stings my nose as the match flame comes to life. I hold it steady for a second or so to make sure it's going to stay lit, then throw it on the bed. Flames stretch and grow as it feeds off the synthetic fibers of the comforter and really take hold once it latches onto the bright red coat. Throwing the last of Amy's belongings into the black duffel bag, I take one last look around the room to make sure I got everything, then toss the bag back into the housekeeping cart. Flames shoot up, and thick black smoke fills the room. That's my cue to go. I pull the hotel room door open and push the cart into the hall, straight to the service elevator that is waiting. Once I'm back on the ground floor, Devin is there waiting for me. I pull out the bag, then hand off the cart to him. We don't speak when we part ways, him going through the parking garage to exit on the other side of the block, while I move through the kitchens to the door that lets out onto a narrow alley on the side of the hotel. I unlock my car and sink into the driver's seat. My hands shake as I pull out my phone and tap in the number I have for emergencies. Mr. Smith answers on the first ring.
What the fuck happened?
He's already heard about the fire. I let out a shaky breath, I'm hoping he can hear. When I entered her room, she was already in the bed. She was extremely intoxicated and had a lit cigarette dangling from her mouth. I approached her with a syringe of Rohypnol, but she became violent the second I was near the bed. The cigarette fell out of her mouth and landed on the bedspread. There was an empty bottle of wine next to her, but the contents must have soaked into the bedding because the entire bed was engulfed in flames within seconds. I reached for her, but she was already on fire. Her clothes... My voice cracks and I shudder out a moan. It was horrific, and so fast. She was just engulfed in flames. I sound frantic, scared. My voice is trembling. He's quiet on the other end.
Was there anything of use in her room?
He finally asks. I don't know. I was going to look after I had her subdued, but had to leave the moment the fire alarm sounded. I answer quickly. I wasn't able to recover anything.
You didn't take anything with you?
No, nothing. I'd stuffed the black bag under my jacket, so there's no reason anyone should have seen me with it. I wait for a response or another question, but there's only silence.
Finally, he says, I understand she hurled a threat at you on the sidewalk in front of the hotel, one that involved me.
She was completely intoxicated, acting crazy. I tell him, but don't deny what she said.
It would be very convenient for you to come into possession of something that could be used against me and tell me you didn't.
There's a chill in his voice I've never heard before. With a shaky voice, I answer, I don't know what she had on you. I didn't find anything at her home, in her car, or in that hotel room. If she had it in there with her, it is nothing but ashes at this point. Silence. Silence that lasts forever. What feels like an eternity later, he says,
we'll be in touch.
Then he ends the call. I lay my head on the steering wheel and take a deep breath. My heart pounds. My hand fumbles as I attempt to turn the key in the ignition. It takes a few minutes, but I finally get the car into drive, and I'm pulling away as more and more fire trucks arrive. Two blocks away, I find a parking spot in front of Wells Fargo Bank. And head inside. Chapter 25. Present day. Once we've entered the bank, We move to the desk where I will sign in to get inside the vault.
Hi, how can I help you?
The woman asks. I give her a smile I don't feel.
Hi, I need to get into my box.
Of course, box number and name?
Regina Hale,
box number 3291. I pull out the ID I used in my last identity and the small key I've kept stashed away for months. She opens the ledger to the page from my box, and I sign underneath the last and only time I've accessed this box. The day it was opened.
You've got company outside. He just arrived, standing near the steps.
I hear Devin whisper through the earpiece. I let out a slow, deep breath while George and I follow the bank attendant through the vault and into a private room, where the walls are lined with little brass doors and a large table sits in the middle. She slides her key into one slot while I slide my key into the other one. We turn it at the same time. Once the door pops open, she says,
"Feel free to put your drawer on the table and take all the time you need."
Then she leaves, shutting the door behind her. It's silent except for the clock on the wall. Tick, tick, tick. The room feels like it's closing in on me. George reaches inside the box and pulls the drawer out, the contents still hidden beneath the closed lid. He sets it on the table. He stares at me. 5 seconds, then 10. We both know there is no going back to the way things were after this. I can see a touch of sadness and maybe even a little regret in his gaze, but I refuse to let any of my emotions show. Finally, he returns his attention to the box in front of him. Slowly, he pulls the lid off. The only thing inside is a small, white origami swan. A look of confusion flashes across his face for 1 second, then 2. The confusion shifts to anger, an anger so consuming that it feels like it sucks the air out of the room. His eyes narrow, and his brows snap together. His jaw clenches. Tick, tick, tick. "I guess I don't need to call you George anymore," I say, if only to drown out the clock. He picks up the swan by one of the little wings and twirls it around. Then he takes his time, slowly opening it up, verifying that the paper is blank. There's no question that there is no information on either him or Victor Connolly in this box. I was prepared for a lot of different reactions, but the unrelenting attention on the empty box wasn't one of them. I used to think you picked Mr. Smith because you were a big Matrix fan or lacked imagination, but you are literally Mr. Smith, Mr. Christopher Smith. Pretty ingenious, actually. Your name is already one of the most generic names out there. I'm rambling. A laugh escapes him, but there's no humor behind it. He finally faces me, the unfolded paper still in his hand. 1 step, then 2. Each step he takes toward me, I take a step back. The paper slips from his hand and floats to the floor. Another step forward. Another step I take back.
When did you figure it out?
Figure out that my boss and my delivery guy were the same person? Figure out your real name? Yesterday afternoon, I answer. He nods to the open safe deposit box.
But this has been waiting for me for much longer.
I nod.
While I'm impressed you were able to discover what so many others have tried and failed to in the past, you knowing my name doesn't change a single thing.
There is an edge to his voice that tells me it's taking everything in him to remain in control.
Where is the information Amy Holder stole from me? You left that hotel just as her room went up in flames, and this was your first stop. Don't lie to me again and say you didn't keep it for yourself.
He glances to the 100 or so other boxes lining the walls, and I can see what he's thinking, that I've got more than one box and it could still be close by. Oh, I got what Amy took. I just didn't leave it here, I say, gesturing to the other side of the room. But I knew you would think I did. That was one of the many lessons you taught me. It's hard to get caught if you aren't in possession of what you stole when they catch you. We're only inches apart now that my back is against the wall. The metal handles of the boxes behind me are digging into my skin. I use the pain to help focus. I may be at his mercy in this room, but there is a crowd on the other side of this door. It won't be easy for him to walk out of here without me, since the woman who let us in is waiting to lock the box back up.
You failed a job for your own benefit.
You're assuming I failed. That job was successful. You just didn't understand what the end goal was. I'm throwing his words back in his face. And from the look he is giving me, I know I'd be dead if we were anywhere other than where we are. He crosses his arms.
It seems we are more alike than you would want to admit. Instead of completing the job you were hired to do, you took advantage of the situation.
The words hit their mark, but I can't let them get in my head. I've learned so much from you over the years. But probably the most important thing I learned was do whatever I must to save myself and the job. Those are words I worked very hard to live up to.
You've come a long way since that trailer park in North Carolina. I had high hopes for you, but what a disappointment you turned out to be.
He sneers at me. I was your best asset, and we both know it. You know nothing about disappointments. He's leaning over me, forcing me to tilt my head back to see his face.
How long have you been planning to betray me?
4 years, I answer, without bothering to correct him. Only half as long as you have been planning to betray me. I can tell he's thinking back, trying to determine what happened 4 years ago that would make me turn on him. Finally, he says,
the Tate job.
I nod. The Tate job. He leans back and spreads his arms out.
Are you going to get to the point of all this? I'm assuming there is a reason for this little stunt.
Amy told you she had information on Victor Connolly and the crimes his family has committed. But what she really had was information that shows you'd been double-crossing them for years. Not a good idea to screw over one of the biggest crime families on the East Coast. She had it all. Wire transfers, documents, and communications that show you've been skimming money, selling their secrets, and using information to your benefit instead of theirs. You've made them think you are protecting them, when in reality you're their biggest threat. But it was useless to have blackmail on you when I didn't know your real name, Christopher. All humor has been wiped from his face.
Cut the bullshit. What do you want, Luca?
Absolutely nothing. And it's Miss Porter now. I've expended all the energy that I care to on you. This is just a friendly warning, since we go back so far. You have some old friends waiting for you outside. We really shouldn't keep them waiting any longer. I stare at him 2 seconds, then three, before I add, did you think I wouldn't have a contingency plan in place? One eyebrow raises as he stares at me. He's always been good at wielding silence like a weapon, and this moment is no different.
Today doesn't end the way you think it does, he says,
his face just inches from mine.
You better look over your shoulder every chance you get, because I promise you one day I will be there.
You've already taken the one thing I've cared about. Luca Marino is gone, dead and buried. There's nothing left for you to hold over me. He moves away from me, and it takes everything in me not to collapse on the floor. He throws the door open, and it slams against the wall. Just before he leaves the vault, I say, don't get sentimental now. It's just business. He's on his phone the second he hits the bank lobby. The woman who let us in the room approaches me, but I wave her off. We don't need the box any longer. The key is still in it. No problem, Mrs. Hale. I just need you to sign the closing documents. I ignore her and follow him out of the bank and see the exact moment he spots Victor Connolly and several members of the Connolly family waiting on the steps outside. He hesitates a few seconds, then ends his call, sliding his phone in his back pocket. He seems to stand a bit taller before walking out to face the man he has stolen millions from. He doesn't look back at me once. He's ushered into the back of the SUV, while Victor Connolly nods at me before getting into the front passenger seat. We had all the information Amy had collected sent to his hotel room last night, with the promise of delivering the man who betrayed him today. I do believe Mr. Smith has probably gotten himself out of a lot of bad spots in the past, but I don't believe he's walking away from this one.
Damn, Al. I wish I would have hooked you up with video, too, because I would have loved to see his face when he opened that box,
Devin says in my ear. I feel like I'm going to vomit. Now that it's over, the adrenaline that has been fueling me is leaving quickly. It's hard to reconcile the guy I knew as George with Mr. Smith.
A total mindfuck. Grab a cab. Your flight leaves in an hour and a half.
Just landed, I text, before throwing my phone on the passenger seat. It's a 30-minute drive to my destination, and I am exhausted. I'm not sure I can make it the last few miles before falling asleep. Thankfully, the driveway comes into sight before too long. I turn in, then make my way down the winding gravel road. The front light is on, which I appreciate since it's completely dark outside. I drag myself from the car, hauling myself up the porch steps. Leaning on the bell, I don't let up until the door jerks open.
That's a little much, don't you think?
Devin says as he pulls the door open. It's been the longest 3 days of my life. I fall onto the couch and kick my shoes off. I'm sleeping for 3 days straight.
There's a bedroom down the hall, he says,
but throws a blanket over me, then cuts out the lamp on the side table because he knows I'm not moving. I guess everything went well. It takes a lot of effort, but I lift my head. She's in simple pajamas, and her hair is sticking up in every direction. And the petty part of me is glad I woke her up after the week I've had. Looks like I won't be going down for your murder after all. Amy Holder lets out a laugh as my eyes fall shut, and I'm dead to the world. Luca Marino, 4 years ago. The Tate job in Fort Worth, Texas, was the first job where I knew for sure I was not the only person doing jobs for Mr. Smith. Since Devin had been watching the security feed for days before I showed up, he was able to get images of the other people sent there for the same purpose. When I asked Devin to track down everyone who tried to retrieve the painting from the Tate home, he did what he could. And it's why I'm standing on a sandy street in a small Florida town, staring at the cutest pink beach house. I can't see the ocean from here, but I can hear it. The front path is just a collection of oddly shaped stones in a loose line leading to the porch. If she's anything like me, she already knows I'm out here. When I'm a few feet from the door, it opens. Hi, I say with a big smile on my face. Can I help you? Amy Holder? Can we talk a minute? She's on guard, as she should be. Same as I would be in her place. Your safe haven is one you protect at all costs and rarely suffer strangers showing up unannounced. You can say what you want from there. I nod and think about the best way to proceed. I need to talk to you about the Tate job in Fort Worth. Raised eyebrows are the only reaction I get from her. We have the same employer, I add. Her arms cross in front of her chest. You should leave. Damn, I can see it in her eyes. She's about to take off. I hold up my hand as if I'm going to stop her from fleeing. I would feel the same way you do right now if someone showed up at my place like this. We really need to talk, but I'm going to put the when and where in your hands. Digging in my bag, I pull out a pen and a receipt from the gas station where I just filled up, then scribble my info on the back. Looking right at her so my sincerity is clear, I say, my number and my real name, the one only a few people have. It's important that we speak. I'll be in Panama City Beach until I hear from you. I walk back to the street, put the paper in her mailbox, and leave without saying another word. I'm taking a huge risk by doing this, but I don't have another choice. It's 5 days before she makes contact. She gives me only 15 minutes notice to meet her at a farmer's market near the beach. It's crowded and loud, and exactly the place I would have suggested if I were her. The only Luca Marino matching your age and ethnicity was the one mentioned in an obituary for Angelina Marino of Eden, North Carolina. I nod, and that's all anyone will find until I decide otherwise. We walk through the stalls, dodging little kids, until we get to a small area full of picnic tables. There's an empty one in the back corner, and she sits down on one side while I sit on the other. So talk. I jump right in. I have a friend who helps me on jobs. He piggybacked on the security system prior to me going in on the Tate job. You were there right after me. You lifted the forgery I left behind. She's quiet for a moment, then finally says, I got my ass chewed out that I handed over a fake and didn't know it. That was probably the ugliest painting I've ever seen. I can see why you wouldn't think anyone would recreate it. I say to break the tension. She laughs. It's quiet and short-lived, but I'll take it. Then my smile fades when I think about what I'll have to tell her. Did you know we weren't the only ones there trying to recover it? She nods. Yeah? I was told it was some sort of bullshit test. Winner got a bonus. I think it was more than a test, I say quietly. My friend was able to identify everyone else, and I went looking for them, just like I did you. And? I clear my throat. And it's just us. We're the only ones left. Amy sits up a little straighter. What do you mean? Mr. Smith was cleaning house, and this was his way of determining who he was keeping and who he wasn't. And it's not like he can just fire us after the things we've seen and done. I list the names of the others and causes of death, while she stares at me, unblinking. I think you were spared since you actually figured out the puzzle by going to the laundry room, even though you walked away with the fake. When I asked Devin to locate everyone he had on video, it was for selfish reasons. This is such a solitary way of life, constantly moving and lying about who you really are. I didn't see the others only as competition. I saw them as potential friends. Others who would understand the challenges of living and working like this. A group where we could be our true selves and possibly even help one another, even if just as sounding boards when tasked with a difficult job. Devin was a bit more hesitant to track down the others, but I won him over. Neither of us were prepared to learn that everyone but Amy was a victim of some grave accident or sudden fatal illness shortly after that job. Amy still hasn't said anything. It's only a matter of time before we're on the wrong side of one of his tests. If it wasn't for my friend, I wouldn't have known to go to the laundry room. He literally saved my life. She looks away from me and stares out into the crowd. I'm not waiting around for him to take me out, I say. Finally, I get a reaction. She frowns as she considers my words and what they mean. So you're what? Quitting? I tried that. There's no quitting. Her voice cracks, and it's clear there is so much she's not saying. Mr. Smith has got to go, I say. She's shaking her head and looking like she's about to get up. I've spooked her. All I can do is push forward. I've been thinking about this for a while, but I can't do it alone. If you're in, we're going to have to take our time, gather everything we can on him, something to use against him. As dirty as he is, you know there is someone he screwed over. We get the details, then we turn him over to them. Let them take him out. Amy stares off to the side, her jaw clenched tight. I keep talking. And we've got to find out who he really is. It doesn't do any good to tell someone he's double-crossed them unless we are also handing over his identity. She's shaking her head. I've thrown a lot at her, and she's not processing it as fast as I'm saying it. We'll protect ourselves at all costs, I add. When it comes time to turn the table on him, we need to control everything down to the last little detail. She stands up and takes the first step to walk away, and I ask, do you have any family that he can use to get to you? Someone you'd do anything to protect? She contemplates whether or not she wants to answer me for a long time. Yeah, there's someone. It's all she says, and I don't push for details. Then we'll have to make sure they are protected. She finally turns to look at me. What about you? No, I don't have anyone. I watch her as she debates what she wants to say. Have you ever told him no on a job? Ever refused to do something he asked you to do? I shake my head. No, I haven't. She looks off, giving me a frustrated laugh. You have no idea what he will do if he finds out what you're planning. I'm a little worried she didn't say what we're planning, but she hasn't walked away. Yet. He'll try to wreck us. But if we get in front of it, it could be like one of those controlled explosions, I say finally. Like when the only way to get rid of a bomb is to detonate it. We'll control as much as we can, so when things explode, like we know they will, the fallout won't be as bad. She laughs again, as if I'm naive. And maybe I am. So you're really doing this, Amy says a bit later. I don't think we have any other option, I answer. Chapter 26. In my line of work, there are the short cons and there are long cons. And I've just finished the longest one of my life. I'm feeling a bit out of sorts now that it's over. I was only slightly joking when I said I was going to sleep for 3 days, since I slept for most of two. Devin and Amy tiptoed around me, making sure there was food close by, and not peppering me with questions like I know they wanted to. Because this was a long job for them, too.
"You're finally awake,"
Devin says as he sinks down in the chair next to the couch. "Barely," I say. "It's like a hangover, but without the fun of getting one." He laughs.
"So too early to bust out the champagne?"
"It's never too early for that," Amy calls out as she enters the room, taking the chair next to Devin. "Morning, if you say so." Just as I'm thinking about how badly I need coffee, Amy sets a mug down in front of me. We're quiet for a moment. Then Amy says, "Wish I could have seen his face in the bank vault when he opened the safe deposit box." Devin laughs.
"I said the same thing."
Shrugging, I say, "I wanted a jaw-dropping look of astonishment that I had bested him, but I only got a raised eyebrow." For the next half hour, I fill them in on all the details of the meeting with the detectives, since Devin wasn't listening in for that. "God, you're lucky he basically sent your twin, or he would have been toast," Amy says. "Even with the alibi from Tyrone, it would have been hard to convince them that wasn't you." I shrug. "We could always have risen you from the dead if prison loomed too close. I'm not actually a murderer." Amy laughs.
"Well, yeah, there's that too."
"It was a good thing Amy was already in that laundry basket before the filming started. I checked that building right before I delivered the body from the morgue, and the room directly across from hers was empty."
Devin frowned, then added,
"I hate when someone gets the jump on me like that."
I pushed my foot against his. "Don't beat yourself up. You've saved our asses more times than either of us would like to admit. Can't be perfect all the time." I thought I'd asked Devin for everything until I asked him to get me a dead body. A very specific dead body. Newly dead, white, female, a Jane Doe who no one would miss. Approximately 5'7" with long blondish hair that we dressed in that unmistakable red coat. For our plan to work, Amy Holder needed to die in a big, splashy way. When we first started preparing for this day, the day we would be free of Mr. Smith, none of us knew just how long it would take to get here. Although the execution took longer than any of us wanted, the plan itself was fairly simple. While we worked through our own jobs, we would look for proof that he was double-crossing any of his own clients. Something big enough that he would fear for his own well-being if it got out. And most importantly, we had to discover his real identity. Amy was right, though. We had no idea what he would do when he started questioning our loyalty. We had to flush out anything he had on us early on, so we could adapt our plan accordingly. Amy stumbled on the Conley double cross, and that was all we needed. So Amy became the sacrificial lamb. She would be the disgruntled employee who would go rogue on a job. If Mr. Smith was holding something in his back pocket that could bring her to heel, he'd be forced to use what he had on her. And he didn't disappoint. It took Amy a long time to tell me about her sister, Heather. They had both been put into the foster care system when they were young, just after their mom overdosed, and no other family showed up to take them in. They were sent to separate families and lost touch. Amy found Heather after she started working for Mr. Smith, using the same resources available to us to do our jobs. We both knew that if Amy had found her, Mr. Smith probably had too. And that's where he hit her. Mr. Smith had evidence ready to go that would result in Heather's arrest for drug use and distribution. And her young daughter, Sadie, would be placed in the foster system. Amy's and Heather's worst nightmare. Devin pulled Heather and Sadie, relocating them to a different state under different names, just after Mr. Smith delivered his first threat against them. This was a temporary fix, but a fix all the same. We controlled that explosion. It also didn't hurt that Heather and Devin hit it off, and he's been very protective of both of them ever since. No one was going to be able to get near her or her daughter. "What does this mean for Heather and Sadie?" I ask Amy now. "Will they head back to Tulsa?" "She likes Phoenix. It wouldn't surprise me if they stayed there. The fresh start has been good for them." Amy grins and turns to Devin. I heard you may be relocating to Phoenix, too.
Maybe,
Devon says with a shrug. But the smile gives him away. Once Heather and Sadie were out of immediate danger, Amy relocated to Atlanta, where she would act wild and unstable. Mr. Smith would be left with only one option: send someone to retrieve what Amy had. Our biggest risk was assuming that I would be given the job. We timed Amy going rogue to coincide with me just finishing a job, so I was available. And truth be told, I was one of the best he had working for him. We had a contingency plan in place in case he didn't send me, but thankfully the job was mine. And while Mr. Smith had people there to watch me watch Amy, they didn't look closely enough at the bartender who served Amy her drinks, or notice that Devon didn't put any alcohol in them. It didn't strike them as odd that every time Amy screamed at me, making sure to let critical information slip at the precise moment we needed it to, it was always in a very public setting, which guaranteed it would trickle back to him. Or that Amy chose Atlanta to ride out this storm she created, which was also home to one of my oldest and most famous friends, who would happily supply me with an alibi. Tyrone made sure we knew Tuesday nights worked best for him. Amy played her part perfectly. She was on a dozen security cameras when she left the bar and walked across the street into that hotel, staggering the whole way. It was no stretch that she would have been careless with her cigarette in that state. I pushed Amy out of that hotel room and the housekeeping cart. Then Devon took over as she continued her escape to the parking garage and into the car we had waiting there. She's been hiding in this cabin ever since. I wanted Mr. Smith suspicious of me, but I wasn't prepared for him having hard evidence that would implicate me in her murder. That came as a surprise to all of us. After Atlanta, the first part of our plan was done. We had enough to bury him. Amy's death ensured she was safe from any further retribution. All we needed was his real name. It was my turn. I needed to push him to use what he had against me, control my own explosion. While we knew Heather and Sadie were a weak spot for Amy, we weren't as confident about where he'd hit me. So I had to play along until he showed his hand. The road trip was my own version of instability. I knew Coach Mitch was my best shot at discovering who Mr. Smith really was, and we could finally play that card now that we had the proof against him. I needed to poke at Mitch, and I knew meeting with Andrew Marshall would send Mr. Smith over the edge, since he's always believed there was a small chance I had the politician in my back pocket. It lit the match for the bomb he had ready for me. Or so he thought. Any word on Smith's whereabouts now? Amy asks, pulling me from my own thoughts. Devon is tapping away on his laptop.
Nothing confirmed. The Connollys will deal with him their own way, which means I don't believe we'll find any identifiable body parts.
I cringe at his words. It's the least of what he deserves after everything Mr. Smith's done. But Devon knew I would struggle with being the one who hand-delivered him to his fate. But it had gotten to the point where it was him or us. I can say this now that it's over. But there were a few moments when I thought he got the best of me. I say quietly. Devon lets out a groan.
Yeah, fake Luca threw me. I never saw where that was headed.
Wish we could have pulled her out in time, I say. Amy leans close and squeezes my arm. We would have if we'd had any idea that's what he was planning. But she's his last victim. I nod and try to take some comfort in that. Did you figure out how deep Ryan is involved? Devon looks up from his laptop. I've put off asking this because I wasn't sure I wanted to know the answer. After Devon planted the info on Amy and James's parents' house, he flew to Virginia, where Mr. Smith lived. While Mr. Smith was following me into that bank, Devon was hacking into his personal computer. Once Devon knew where to look, the floodgates were opened, and he was able to discover every facet of his business.
His only involvement was what we already knew. Smith used his services over the years. As Ryan's business increased, so did Smith's interest in him. I believe he intended to take over Ryan's business, just as he had said to you. From what I've gathered so far, and it will be a while before I've gone through everything, Ryan knew him from those previous transactions, but wasn't privy to the scope and breadth of Smith's organization.
Amy sits up in her chair, her eyes darting between Devon and me. Then why was Smith giving him the info on his own business?
Devin shrugs. Not really sure. I'm guessing Smith had his reasons for doing that. But short of asking Ryan, we may never know.
Well, then I guess we'll never know, I say. Amy lets out a laugh. Seriously? You're not going to ask him?
I can't help the grimace that takes over my face.
I can't ask him.
Sure you can,
Devin says, his focus once again back on the laptop. What would be the point? The job is finished, and I'm on the straight and narrow from here on out. No more illegal activities for me.
Amy rolls her eyes.
Going straight doesn't mean you have to be finished with him. He's morally gray, you're morally gray. Plus, he's super hot and probably great in bed.
I give her 3 months before she's calling me and saying, Devin, so there's this job.
His high-pitched impression of my voice has me laughing as I roll my eyes. I give her 1 month, Amy says. I throw a couch pillow at both of them. We stay in the cabin another 3 days while Devin digs through the rest of Mr. Smith's files he copied from his computer. But this time away from the real world can't last forever.
Okay, ladies, I'm out,
Devin says, loaded down with his backpack and bag. His car is already packed with his equipment. He's the first one to leave, and Amy and I take turns giving him hugs, but I'm the only one who follows him out to the porch. We did it, I say. His smile stretches across his face.
That we did.
He pauses before saying,
when you get over thinking you're done with this life, let me know.
I am done, I say, although it lacks conviction. And we can get together for fun. It doesn't always have to be work-related. Devin walks to his car, laughing.
Of course we can. I'm ready when you are.
He throws his stuff in the back seat before taking off. Amy is the next to leave. You'll text me when you get settled, right? She asks me. Yes. And then I'll see you in a couple of weeks. I help her get her bags to the car. Then we throw our arms around each other and stay there for a long moment. Then she too is gone. I stay a little longer at the cabin. There are things to do, plans to make, decisions to consider. But for one blessed week, there is quiet. Alias, Evie Porter. 4 months ago. It's Thursday, and Ryan Sumner is right on time. He pulls up to the gas pump on the farthest side, just like always. He's a bit casual today, his usual button-down replaced with one of those pullover golf shirts with the logo of the local club. I wonder what made this Thursday different. I tug my skirt up just a fraction higher and run my hands through my hair, making sure it falls just the way I want it to. I knew coming in that this was going to be my most dangerous job. Mr. Smith sent me here to break me. I'm going to play this one by the book. I won't step out of line, won't get ahead of the game. I will let it unfold around me and wait for Mr. Smith to hit me with everything he's got before I hit back. Hello, I say as I walk up to his car. He's startled but hides it quickly and easily.
Hey,
he replies, a grin spreading across his face. He's cuter in person. I tilt my head in the direction of my car, which is sitting off to the side, its left rear tire completely flat. Any chance I can get some help with that? My dad taught me how to change my tire years ago, and in theory, I remember the basics, but it's a little more daunting when you're faced with it in real life. His smile grows, and it lights up his whole face. And it's a very lovely face indeed.
Of course, he says. Let me just finish up here and I'll pull around.
I give him a high-wattage smile right back, then return to my car. He parks beside me and eyes me when he gets out. I'm leaning against the side of the car, showing off in just the right way. Ryan goes to his trunk, retrieving his jack, before kneeling down in front of my flat tire. I crouch down beside him, his eyes lingering on my legs a few seconds, like I hoped they would. I know from my research that he likes to play golf and tennis, though he's not exceptionally good at either one. I know he went to LSU and was social chair for his fraternity. I know he dated a girl through sophomore and junior year, but that she broke it off before she left to study abroad. You look really familiar, I say, as he loosens the first lug nut off my tire. He glances at me and says,
I was just thinking the same thing.
Did you know Callie Rogers? We were friends at LSU. From his expression, I know he recognizes the name, but can't place her. I studied the girls who had been in sororities around the same time he was there. Girls who were tagged in posts of his friends' friends, but never with him. Their names would be familiar, but not familiar enough that he would ever ask them about me.
Was she friends with Marty Brighton?
Yes!
I think I met her a time or two when she was with Marty, he says,
then gets back to work. Once the mutual connections have been made, I'm no longer thought of as a stranger, and the conversation is easy. Even though Ryan has finished changing the tire, he lingers. We're both leaning against the car now, turned toward each other. I should buy you a drink, I say. The least I can do for saving me. He leans in a few inches closer.
I'll let you buy me a drink if I can buy you dinner.
Ryan is smooth. I feel like I already know you, but we haven't been officially introduced. I hold my hand. Not far, since we're already so close. I'm Evie Porter. His hand slides into mine.
Ryan Sumner.
Well, Ryan, I say. Drinks and dinner sound like a great idea.
Follow me?
He asks. Right behind you. I answer. We pull into a small bistro, and he's at the driver's side door before I can open it. Ryan holds his hand out, helping me from the car. We step inside the restaurant, where he asks for us to be seated on the patio. It's still chilly outside this time of year, even though we're in Louisiana. My short skirt offers no protection, but I'm relieved when I see several heaters scattered around the area. Twinkle lights stretch between the trees that border the patio. It's a dreamy spot for a first date. We order wine and appetizers, and we talk and talk and talk. He leans toward me, and I mirror him.
Tell me more about you,
he says, just as our main course is served. Thoughts about Mama and that small trailer we called home, that Mama made a home, wash over me. And for the first time, I don't want to tell the first lie. I want to tell him how she taught me to sew, and how we made dresses for every stuffed animal I had. How we had tea parties and acted like we were royalty. I wanted to tell him about the map of the world that hung on the wall. We would throw a dart and then learn everything we could about the place it landed on. But I stick with the script and tell him my parents died in a car wreck, and I'm just trying to find my way. I weave more truth than I should into the story. Give him more of myself than I've ever given anyone else. His hand slides across the table, and I steel myself for how good I know it will feel. And it feels good. Too good. So I pull away slightly. Not enough to make him feel rejected, just enough to give myself some distance. I mentally wall up my emotions, brick by brick. Ryan Sumner is a job, one that won't last. He's charmed by Evie Porter, a figment of my imagination. It's time to remember exactly who she is and why she's here. It's time to get to work. Evie Porter, present day. Ryan is in the front yard pushing a lawnmower back and forth along his perfectly green grass. The sun is setting and the dying light is throwing a golden glow over the two-story white house, making it shimmer. He spots me as he makes his second pass and kills the engine immediately. He's wearing old, faded khaki shorts and a light blue tee that is frayed around the edges. I'm on the sidewalk watching him watch me. Neither of us moves for several minutes. It's been 3 months since that morning in the hotel in Atlanta. He meets me halfway, grass trimmings coat his legs and shoes, and his hands are streaked with grease. My eyes scan his face for any little change since I saw him last. I'm hoping you still want to talk, I say. Ryan pulls a rag from his back pocket, then uses it to clean his hands. After a long moment, he finally looks up at me and nods toward the house. Without waiting to see if I'll follow, he starts making his way around the side of the house to the backyard. My eyes snag on the three long rows of plants that are bursting with vegetables in the back corner of the yard. Ryan arranges the two Adirondack chairs so they are facing each other, rather than sitting side by side, motioning for me to take one. I choose the one that puts my back to the yard. I can't look at that garden right now. He grabs two beers from a nearby cooler, passing one of them to me.
I thought it would be better to talk without the prying eyes of the neighborhood watch. Although I should thank you. The little old ladies on this street have given me a wide berth after the spectacle in the driveway, and they've grown weary of throwing their granddaughters at me.
I'm available anytime you need your good name tarnished, I say, then take a sip of my beer.
It was never as shiny as you once thought it was. We can stop pretending whenever you're ready.
I take a deep breath and blow it out slowly, hoping to calm my nerves. I'm not sure I know where to start. I've been pretending a long time. Ryan's head tilts to the side as he studies me. While Devin, Amy, and I can speculate until we're blue in the face, we don't know Ryan's side of this, or what he knew about me or Mr. Smith. The only thing we do know is Ryan did business with Mr. Smith in some capacity, but he has been the sole owner of the operation in East Texas since his grandfather died. I also know there's something unfinished between us, and I had a strong desire to see him again, that time has not lessened.
I should make you go first, since you've taken your sweet time to come talk to me.
He puts his beer on the little side table, then leans back in his chair, his head resting in the cradle of his joined hands.
You were something I wasn't prepared for. Did I know you were trying to get information on the business in Glenview when I fixed your flat tire? No. Even before I met you, I could tell something was wrong there. Things had been moved around at work and at home. Shit missing. It got worse after I met you, but I didn't link it to you. Not at all.
He gives me a lopsided grin and a shrug that tells me he knows he should be embarrassed, but he's not.
An associate I've done business with off and on over the years told me he was hearing rumors that someone had infiltrated my operation and was selling info on my shipments to the highest bidder.
An associate? I ask. He shakes his head.
No more from me until I get a little from you.
He takes a deep drink from his bottle, then puts it back down on the table. You were a job. I was having trouble with my boss, and he wasn't happy with me. When I got assigned to you, I wasn't sure if this was a real job, not in the usual way. My boss, he liked to play games, test me to make sure I was still loyal. Needless to say, I wasn't sure if you were playing me too. Ryan's eyes narrow as he tries to understand what I'm saying, since I'm not being as clear as I should be.
That sounds fucked up. Your boss seems like an incredible asshole.
My laugh surprises us both. You have no idea. It's so much harder than I thought it would be to just be honest. If the associate that warned you someone was selling the details on your shipments was the same guy you were talking to in the motel corridor in Tennessee, then you met my boss. He leans forward, the laid-back attitude long gone.
I didn't know you heard us talking. Is that why you freaked out and left? And yeah, that was him. But he was your boss?
His eyes glaze over as he tries to sort through his confusion.
He told me you were the one stealing files from me.
Yeah, that sounds about right. Pitting two people against each other is his favorite pastime. Or I should say, was his favorite pastime. He thought it provided the best results. One side working against the other, no one trusting anyone. And he conveniently watches from the sidelines. We're studying each other, comparing what we once believed against what we're learning about each other right now. When did he tell you it was me? And why would you stay with me when you found out I was betraying you? I ask. Ryan keeping me around made sense when I thought he was Mr. Smith.
He texted me just before we left the police station. Asked me to meet him. Said he had some information for me. That's where I went when I dropped you here and told you I needed to go by my office.
He laughs, but it's hollow. He looks off toward the backyard.
It's easy to see how he played me, looking back. Told me someone approached him, offering a partnership since they knew he'd used my services in the past, and thought he'd like to cut out the middleman. But he made me believe he was on my side, was making sure they didn't succeed. He told me you were using me to get close enough to get my financials, my client records, shipments records, handed me proof. Said you were meeting with your contact in Atlanta to give them the rest of the stuff you had on me. And they promised to help you get out of this trouble with the police. I agreed to stick close to you. I wanted to know who was behind this. Who sent you to do their dirty work? I was so fucking pissed off. I sat in my car in the driveway and read through everything he gave me.
Ryan finally turns to look back at me, leaning forward in his chair, with his elbows resting on his knees.
But then I was more confused than ever, he says,
his voice strong but quiet.
Everything he gave me as proof of what you had taken from me was altered. The dates of big shipments were a week later than I planned. The cargo smaller. The buyer's names changed. It didn't make sense. And it was enough for me to doubt what he was trying to make me believe. And then I went inside. I went looking for you, and I found you in the shower, and you were so broken. Crying so hard I thought you'd break in a million pieces. It was the exact same way I felt. I knew there was a big piece I was missing.
He gives me a sad smile.
I was going to ride it out and see where we landed.
His stare is so intense, I have to look away. Coughing to clear the lump in my throat, I finally say, he wasn't the only one playing a game. I needed him mad at me, madder than he already was. I needed to lose his trust completely, but I also didn't want you to lose your business to him. I didn't want it to become another cog in the wheel of his organization. So I changed the details. Ryan reaches forward, his hand sliding around the legs of my chair, and pulls me a little closer.
Tell me the rest of it.
Taking a deep breath, I tell him about Devin and Amy, without giving away their names. I tell him about Eden, North Carolina, and living in that trailer with Mama until she died. I tell him about Mr. Smith and George, and how I didn't know they were the same person until it was almost too late. I told him about the woman who claimed to be me, and how her life and James's were cut short just so Mr. Smith could make a statement. At some point while I was unburdening myself, Ryan had pulled me into his lap. My head leaning against his chest, his hand brushing through my hair as he listened to all my secrets. I'm sorry James got wrapped up in this. If I had known what was in store for them, I would have found a way to pull them both out.
I know you would have.
We sit in silence long enough that the sun starts to set. I should be ashamed of how easy it was to fall back into the daily routine with Ryan. The only difference this time is we're both honest about how shady we are. It's Thursday, and Ryan is headed to East Texas.
I'll be home by 6,
he says as he fills his travel mug with coffee. He's dressed in jeans and a tee, since he doesn't have to act like he's headed to his local office. I'll be here. I move in close, wrapping my arms around him. He buries his face in my neck and peppers me with kisses.
Want me to pick up some steaks on the way home?
That sounds good. There's a ton of squash and zucchini we need to eat, so we can grill those too. The neighbors run from me now. Ryan laughs.
That's what happens when half of the backyard is a garden and we have to palm veggies off on everyone.
One more kiss, and then he mumbles against my lips.
Try to be a good girl while I'm gone.
Laughing, I say, I'll try, but I make no promises. He leaves, and I watch him drive away until he's out of sight. I top off my coffee and head to the small home office I created for myself out of one of the guest bedrooms. It takes a few minutes to settle in and get everything powered on. Devin created this space, and we take every precaution. I place the call on the secured line, and Amy picks up on the first ring. Morning, she says, although she still sounds half asleep. She kept her same first name, but now goes by the last name of Porter as well. I guess I wasn't the only one looking for a connection with someone else. Morning, I say back, as I log on to the King Harvest fans message board. The alert box pops up, showing there are new messages, while the first few bars of the chorus of Dancing in the Moonlight plays over my computer speakers. Two new messages, I tell her. I hear Amy yawn, and then she says,
open them up and let's see what they're looking for, Miss Smith.
It's my favorite part of the morning. This is Saskia Marleveld. We hope you've enjoyed this unabridged production of First Lie Wins, a novel by Ashley Elston. This program was directed by Joseph Ward. Executive producer, Brian Ramcharan. Edited by BookTrack. Text copyright 2024 by Ashley Elston. Production copyright 2024.
Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.